All right, this meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:07 PM Thursday, May 9th, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Clayman, Representative Drummond, Co-Chair Zilkowski, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already done so for the duration of the meeting. Before we get started, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Tech Secretary from Records, and Taylor Kelly from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as Katie Giorgio and Ted Matson, our trustee Health and Social Services Committee aides. Today we're going to be hearing a series of presentations on the topic of substance abuse treatment. We've been working on crime and a crime bill or series of crime bills for much of the last month, and I feel that any conversation about crime in the state of Alaska is incomplete without a discussion about the need to address addiction, which drives the vast majority of crime in the state of Alaska. And so I want to thank Co-Chair Zilkowski for agreeing to host this presentation today. We have a few presenters, so I'm asking committee members to hold questions for the end of each presentation so we can make sure we stay on schedule. Welcome, Representative Tarr. We have a hard stop right at 5 o'clock, so I just want to give everybody's attention to that, and I will call time periodically through the meeting to make sure, you know, if we start to run a little bit long, so we can make sure that we get through everybody's presenters. So first up, we have Andy Jones from the Office of Drug Control Policy. You're going to come forward, put yourself on the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Jones. I am the director for the Office of Drug Control Policy within the Department of Health and Social Services Office of the Commissioner. So today I was asked to kind of give a quick overview or the starting point of the epidemic, and having a couple new faces, I always like to start from the beginning. Doing this for the last 2.5 years, myself and my previous boss, Dr. Butler, we were really entrenched in this, so we assume everybody knows everything about the opioid epidemic. So I've got about 20 slides, and be more than happy to follow up with questions. The first slide I always like to talk about is just the magnitude of this problem we have. Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of accidental deaths in the United States, exceeding automobile deaths. You know, I commute every day from the Matsu Valley, so when I see this, it's just astronomical. The third bullet's the one that really hits home to me. Being a prior veteran myself, if you were to take the Vietnam War and the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq right now, we are losing more Americans in a year's time than we are in those wars and conflicts and combinations. So last year we lost about 65,000 Americans to drug overdose deaths. That's not just opioids, that's all categories. Mm-hmm. This year in 2017, so 2016 was about 65,000. In 2017 it was increased in the country to 70,237. If you were to look at the age-adjusted rate of these deaths, in about 1999, we were seeing about 6.1 per 100,000 population, and last year it skyrocketed to 21.7 per 100,000 in population. Now, I want to set the scenario there, and please try to I'll highlight those numbers, because one of my last slides is I'm kind of excited today, because usually I come in and I paint a dark, grim picture. And I think we're seeing some change, and so I'm hoping to paint a little bit more of a positive picture and note here. So I'm excited to show the last slide there.
So, Mr. Jones, yes, before ma'am. Before you do that, I just want to note for the record that Speaker Edgman is with us as well. Thank you. Thank you.
Moving on with my presentation, slide two. How did this happen? Now, I want to start out by saying the epidemic, this isn't the first time we've had it. We've been in a series of waves, and Dr. Butler used to say it's kind of like a tsunami, and this is probably our third time we've had this happen. And I won't go through the deep history of it, but you can get on Wikipedia or any of those sites and read, and they're pretty amazing. But with the prescription pill problem that we've had, the driving factors were medical fallacies and increased prescribing. So pain can be objectively measured. It's kind of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your pain? It's always impossible to answer. You know, one day it's 10, next day it might be an 8. It's like saying on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your blood pressure today? It just doesn't work. Mentalities of tolerance is just underdosing. Those have definitely driven the overprescribing. A good friend of mine, Dr. Ann Lemke, once said a person seeking, or that pseudo-addiction, a person who's seeking drug-seeking behavior are simply in pain and need more opioids. It's these type of thought processes, and this is no fault of the doctor or the medical community. It's, you know, these doctors go through a lot of training and education, and they can't be a skilled person in every single category. It's like me as a helicopter pilot. I can't fly every single aircraft in such a small amount of training. And so a lot of these doctors only get maybe a couple hours of pain management training, and you could see how this has just continued to build upon the problem. To include also, as a country, instead of sometimes doing the appropriate things like physical therapy, if it's going to work for an individual, we are looking for a quick fix. And I think that's not just on the individual, but it's our workforce. There's so many compounding factors. The scare that I have and what we're seeing in the country is we're starting to move, because we've been so aggressive on the prescription and the doctor aspect of it, is we're starting to see a transition from the prescription opioid problem to more of the illicit street drug problems, heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil. We read them in the newspaper every single day. As you can see right here, approximately 3 out of 4 new heroin users reported misusing prescription opioids. I was an athlete. Still like to say I'm an athlete. Now with kids, it's a little harder. But, you know, when you get hurt, I remember, hey, here's an Oxy. Or, you know, here's something for the pain. And such an innocent individual who's playing a sport gets injured, and the next thing you know, you hear these stories of people becoming addicted to the substance. Heroin doesn't require a prescription. The street price of heroin is very cheap. Now, in Alaska, it's a little bit more, I would say, due to geographical distances, logistics, but still, it's much cheaper than what a prescription pill would be in the urban and rural areas. The farther you get outside of the urban areas, it gets very, very expensive. The danger, obviously, is, you know, there is a risk and can be a high risk of overdose with a prescription medication if you misuse it, but with the street drugs, it's even worse. You don't know what you're getting. You don't know if there's fentanyl in it. Quick story, you probably heard in the news, our partnership with law enforcement officials just seized a lot of fentanyl, and it was pill-pressed in Mallinckrodt 30s. So if you were to have a chronic pain patient who couldn't get their prescription anymore and was going to the street and thought this was a Mallinckrodt 30 and started taking them, it would have been almost instant death for them because it's pure fentanyl. Now, a lot of people ask, why do dealers do that? You know, it's cheaper for fentanyl. Yet if you pill-press it and you show it as a Mallinckrodt 30, you can make a lot of money off of it. It's a money-moving environment when it comes to drug trafficking organizations. You can see has morphine's pretty dangerous, heroin's very dangerous, fentanyl makes it even more dangerous. This came from the Department of Public Safety. I want to first highlight opioid incidences and methamphetamine incidences. First, I want to point out, if you look at 2018, you may see the numbers are down when I was able to pull this data. We still have current cases open, and so they do take time with investigations. I bet you those numbers, by the time cases are closed, will be pretty close. As you can see, methamphetamine is probably one of our biggest problems today. No longer is it the local cooking in the labs. We're seeing this stuff coming from Mexico, and it's coming in very high potency and purity rates. So it's a very big scare for us. Methamphetamine is, I guess I could say it snuck up on us in the country as we were focusing on the opioid epidemic. But, you know, I think the important thing here to say is, and one thing we'll talk about is, we're moving towards more of a polysubstance approach when it comes to our response. Yes, we focused a lot on opioids, and yes, we still do, and the money's there. But whenever we secure money, we're looking at trying to make our resources, our capabilities, our capacities as broad as possible. And you can see alcohol is still our biggest problem in the state, across the state. Methamphetamine's big, heroin's still big, and we're starting to see a presence of cocaine coming back. I promise I've got positives here. Here's just a slide, and what I want to hit home on this is polysubstance misuse. It is a polysubstance epidemic, and this is one of the problems with us is response agencies in the past. Coming from doing some interdiction and things like that, we focus, like I said, on one substance, and then something sneaks up behind us. So that's why we're starting to put so much of an emphasis on looking at, okay, what does methamphetamine treatment look like? What does the interdiction processes potentially look like? And trying to be more ahead of the game. Real quick, going back to this, when an individual in Alaska does die from a drug overdose death, I would say about 95% of those individuals usually always have a multiple substances in them. So it'd probably be marijuana, alcohol, heroin. Those seem to be obviously the combinations, methamphetamine. Moving on to our response structure, a little bit of history real quick. In 2007, we actually declared a state disaster. Now, a lot of people thought we declared the state disaster for the opioid epidemic, but what we really did was we had this really great grant to do naloxone. And Dr. Butler at the time, we were looking at all the programs across the country, and we wanted to make it as easy as possible. Coming from government, I know we love paperwork. We love to mess processes up sometimes and make it even worse. And so simplistic.
Speak for yourself there, Mr. Jones.
and so we made it to where we were an umbrella organization. We put all these tools together, but we created as much flexibility. And so what we realized, though, is to do that, we had to have statewide medical standing orders, and we didn't have that at the time. And so when you go to declare a disaster, in my old role, I used to be a disaster guy, you always got to define, is there a loss of life, is there a loss of property, and if the community exceeded their needs. And I think you could easily say that about this epidemic. People have died, crime relation to the epidemic, we've had property that's been destroyed, and our communities are asking for help. So we declared a disaster. And I got to thank the legislature passing SB 91. Probably should retire that number, but it isn't the criminal reform bill. It's the opioid extension of the opioid epidemic. And so to this day, we are pushing more naloxone than any other state in the country, and we are saving a whole bunch of lives, and we'll get to that. What you see here on the slides is our structure. This is what it is called an incident command system. So no different than a flood, flu, or fire. This is how we operate. And it takes all state agencies. Now, when I first started this, or we started it, excuse me, it was a couple agencies, and then more, and then more. And now what we've actually started doing is we are including locals, tribal, federal, and our state partners. So we have, like, union reps on there. We're really starting to make this more of a true multi-agency approach. And that's usually been the failure in a lot of responses in the past is communications and exclusion of the people who really need to doing the work on the ground. Some of the approaches is we have a multi-agency approach, multi-agency coordination group, which means if the commissioners come together, we brief on a monthly basis. We utilize the Alaska Criminal Information and Analysis Center, ACIAC, which is with the troopers, and that's fed to the incident commander and deputy incident commander. And what that is really is telling us about the different drug trends that are going on, and it helps me as an individual to focus my prevention and treatment efforts and where we should be putting our resources. And then a joint information system, which really just helps us to be coordinated. The big thing here on this slide, you may have seen this from past presentations, is cross-sectoral collaboration is really, really, really important here. If you don't have all the pieces and all the players together, I can guarantee you're going to be going back in your processes and duplicating something. And so we've learned just to include everybody who has a piece to play in here. When I seem like I'm always missing somebody. So when we first started the 2007 response, a lot of states across the country, there was only a few of us that declared disasters. Our state had an opioid policy task force that was formed in 2016, released a document, I think it was either December of 2016 or January of 2017. It was a good document, but what I heard from the locals was it's a policy document. So it's meant for people like myself, legislators, representatives, senators, but it wasn't really meant for the community. And if you've ever read the book Dreamland, there's an author, Sam Kionis, and he says, isolation fuels addiction, community is the cure. And so if this isn't going to work for the community, then we needed to change something up. But we needed to have a response framework. And Dr. Butler and I initially sat down and said, should we be working on a plan right away, or should we be saving lives? And I think that's a pretty easy answer. And so we actually started right away saving lives. Now, you guys have seen me carry these around. This is our Narcan kits. But this is what we chose to do, is saturate the market. It's a tourniquet, but it saves Alaskans' lives. You know, this isn't a moral failing. It's just a chronic condition of the brain, and people need help. They need more than one chance quite often. We also got these drug disposal bags out to start reducing prescription drugs in houses. Now, this came from actually when I worked in Kivalina and Newtok. I remember going by the dumps eventually a couple times and seeing pill bottles here and there and thought, man, there's got to be an easier way to get rid of things. These little bags are really cool. Activated charcoal, you put your substance in there, fill it halfway with lukewarm water, you shake it up, it destroys it. Now, if you decide to eat it, it's activated charcoal, so it's not going to be fun coming up, but it won't kill you. It won't harm the environment, they say. They say it biodegrades. I still try to figure out how long that'll take, but it's a much better tool than what we currently have in the state for getting rid of medications, and so we've been pushing these out quite a bit. I'll talk more about the state opioid action plan, but you can see our opioid initial response framework. And so on the tip of the spear, the tertiary prevention was naloxone, working with our syringe and needle exchanges, which have been extremely helpful in the state of Alaska for us because we do not have drug paraphernalia laws, so we can actually open these sites. So we could either not have these sites and have needles everywhere and by now we would have a hepatitis C and HIV outbreak, but that's been a very very essential tool. It also has been great for us because it helps us connect with the individual who's suffering. Instead of searching everywhere, there's an environment that a lot of times individuals will go to. As you can see, I don't go through everything, but secondary prevention was increasing screening, reducing the stigma, understanding addiction as a chronic disease, and then primary prevention, which is the hard stuff, is things like ACEs, adverse childhood experience, judicious prescribing, really doing that upstream prevention that we're talking about and working on right now. And like I said, I'll get to the statewide opioid action plan. So just a couple prevention resources, because I know Director Monroe Johnson will be on next, and I don't want to go too in-depth, but with prevention, we have secured quite a bit of funding. One of the things we have is the Partnership for Success coalitions across the state. I know there's one in like Sitka, Anchorage. They're actually all over, and this is a coalition that comes together to focus on substance use disorders, misuse, really a community-based organization. The Community Substance Misuse and Abuse Task Forces, this has been a driving factor, and we'll talk about the success we've seen with these, but these are, like in the Matsu where I'm from, is a bunch of just local citizens who come together, and it's been phenomenal. I sit on that task force there, and it's been fun to see the changes that we're making. Anchorage has got one, and it's been a great opportunity, because what that ends up doing is it force multiplies. I have a staff of 8 people. Can't do a lot with 8, but you can do quite a bit of cool things. But when you take the community members and you force multiply, you know, we end up being a team of hundreds of people. And I think that's a good approach. And that comes from the military through unconventional warfare. And it seems to work really well for us. 6 months into our response, we created OSMAP, the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention, that's been focused on naloxone, upstream prevention. Our sole focus is integrating public health approaches to reduce or to minimize substance use disorders. And then data dashboards and our website, some of our website on opioids. Real quick, talking about the Alaska State Troopers and the statewide drug enforcement units, I think this is an important piece because as we do talk about treatment, we also want to talk about enforcement and the criminal. So we can't just arrest our way out, but we can't just treat our way out of this. It's a real balanced approach is what I'm learning, because as we have traffickers, DTOs, which is drug trafficking organizations or cartels who may come into our state, we need these units to be focusing on those individuals who are feeding on the misery of Alaskans, hooking Alaskans to these substances, while the Department of Health, in partnership with the Alaska State Troopers and other agencies, are working on enhancing, building the capacities of treatment capability. What you see here are some of the different narcotics interdiction teams. This isn't just troopers. These are made up of local, tribal, state, and federal agencies. Real quick about corrections. Corrections has got approximately 80% of its offenders are in custody struggling with substance abuse. 30% of those who are assessed report abusing opioids. This is probably one of our biggest populations when it comes to substance use disorders. They've been working on building a comprehensive substance abuse program. Right now they have Vivitrol is one of their MAT, medication-assisted treatments, in their programs. So upon reentry or release, they'll get this shot if they qualify, and then they go through the reentry service programs and are connected to the community. So they are working on that. One of the things they've been talking about is increasing and looking at the increased footprint of medication-assisted treatment. And that could be things like, you know, bridging with methadone or integration of Suboxone, those type of MAT requirements. This is actually new across the country. A lot of people assume Suboxone is in the prison system, methadone is. It is not. And so there's some pretty neat things I think we as a state and as a country are starting to move towards when it comes to the prison population. If we're able to get them treatment and care from day one, is a lot better than giving them treatment and care a month before release, I see. Policy. So partnerships, outcomes, and results. I think this says a lot about the partnerships we have as legislators and state workers. We are working right now to implement the patient voluntary non-opioid directive that came from one of our previous governor's bills. So hopefully that'll be on the street here very soon. State medical standing orders, naloxone distribution, controlled substance emergency scheduling. We have the authority now to emergency schedule substances as long as it's on the federal list. This is nice because we can take immediate action if we're seeing a trend in a certain substance that's coming through our community. Limits first-time opioid prescriptions to 7-day supplies with exceptions, and that helps with rural Alaska because sometimes once you get out into one of your smaller communities, it's hard to get that. And so it's a pretty, you know, as long as you write into the PDMP that exception of what it's for, you should be good to go. and then requirements for the prescription drug monitoring program. We had a system that wasn't mandatory, and then we made it, you know, we started building upon that, and we went in 2018 to daily, and that's been very instrumental. Real quick about community coalitions, we already talked about it. Isolation fuels addiction, community provides the cure. These are the true boots on the ground individuals. If this is one of your communities, I would recommend or let me know. I'll get you the times and dates. It's great to go into these meetings. You really find out what's going on in your community. Prevention with our partnerships, Project HOPE. HOPE stands for Harm Reduction, Overdose Prevention, and Education. We currently have, I think, about actually 102 overdose response programs, distributed over 18,000 overdose rescue kits, and over 260 lives saved. Now, I can guarantee you we have saved way more lives, but the way we set this program up is I don't mandate individuals to have to tell their story or tell, because if you start doing these mandates, what ends up doing is you put so much stigma on the individual, they'll never come back. They'll never eventually tell your story. And so having 260 people tell their story, that's a pretty remarkable number. Those medication disposal bags, 46,000 bags distributed since 2007, that's given us the potential to reduce over 2 million pills in our state. And that's been really important because what we have to do with DEA take back, at least this last year, is we don't have an incinerator, a large incinerator anymore in Anchorage. And so we have to fly all those pills with a C-130 out of state. And that's expensive. A lot of times it'll be a training mission. And so this gives us an opportunity to make drug take back an everyday occurrence instead of once or twice. And you know, this is my world, and I still have a hard time sometimes getting to these events when it's once or twice a year. We are doing Opioids 101. We did that with the Department of Education. It's available for teachers, parents. We've also got first responder training. It's really compassion fatigue training because we heard a lot from different first responders who were getting burned out. I mean, when you see this day in and day out and you may sometimes see the same individual, it's exhausting and it's hard. And so we're really focusing on our community who's responding. Also, the Fatal Overdose Death Review Committee, that is something we're looking at implementing and starting, where it's no different than the Maternal Child Death Review Committee. We look at the cases, we start to really say, is policy working, is prevention working, what's going on, and digging into those cases. Enforcement, we were awarded the last designation so far. It's called the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. This is really, really important. I equate this to kind of like the special operations of narcotics. This brings in about $2.5 million a year from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and it will go to various task forces from that previous slide across the state. What this actually does is this increases our footprint to do things like better interdiction, better information sharing, so we understand what is being seized throughout the entire state and getting better stats, developing better private sector partnerships, paying for overtime for officers. So we're really excited. We just hired a HIDA director. He's a former DEA individual, very sharp individual. He won't be the operations, but he'll be building the system in partnership with all of our local, state, and federal partners. So that's exciting. Strategic direction. So here's something this was extremely fun last year. We traveled the state. I think it was after I presented to this committee, we went out and traveled to over 15 communities. And these 15 communities is where we actually did community cafe events to build a statewide opioid action plan. But we also went to a whole bunch of other communities and did town hall events. It was about what the community wanted. Now, in these community cafe events, it was one day where we went and worked with the medical community in their jurisdiction to understand what are the barriers, what are the gaps. Because people will tell you one-on-one a whole bunch of stuff. And then day two was the entire community was invited. We had the community cafe set up to where you had prevention, treatment, reentry, the correctional criminal justice population, and these individuals would go around and they would talk about what's currently in their community, what's not working, what are the barriers to change, and what is needed. We took all this data, UAA helped us compile it, and then we brought in 100 people, subject matter experts from all over the state in August of 2017 to do, I think it was a 2.5-day statewide planning event, and they took all the information from the community, and we actually built a plan from the ground up. Now, that's rare, I would have to say, doing something like that, to the point where the country is now looking at this. So this has been great. This is our long-term approach when you look at this plan. It's taken us from, I would say, a 100,000-foot level down to maybe more of the 20, hopefully 10,000-foot level. And we're going to be using this document to help fund some of our coalition activities in the future with some of our grant fundings hopefully we'll secure from the federal government. But this plan was built by Alaskans, and I hope it will be executed by Alaskans. Okay, so this last slide. When I talked about how the country has seen an increase in drug overdose deaths throughout the country, from 1991, I think it was 6.1, to 2017, we're at 21.7% age-adjusted rate increase. Now, I know these numbers are not easy to look at, and these are still prelim results, but when you look at Alaska, and you look at our numbers in 2018, we're seeing downward trends across the board. So, for example, in drug overdose deaths, in 2015, we had an age-adjusted rate of 16%, increased to 17 in 2016, increased again to 19.3, in 2018 it went down to 11.9%. Not only just in drug overdoses as a whole, but look at fentanyl. The country is battling fentanyl, and we went from 28 deaths in 2017 to 7. Now, I'm excited about that, but we still have a lot of people we need to get into treatment. There's still a lot of people who are dying, and that's not appropriate. I'd love to see all these numbers at zero. But I think this has been the hard work of, when you go across the country, we have a sense of community in Alaska. And I think we as partners have done a great job to work to remove the stigma of use. We still got some work ahead of us, but we've got some other barriers we're working on. I also think naloxone has been a great help for us, but it is a tourniquet. And so I think a combination of all these factors, you know, sound policy put in place, we're seeing these numbers decrease. And so this is a good trend for us. I'm really excited about this. This doesn't mean that we can sit back and go, whew, the job's done. It means now we really got to be more diligent, because if you look at past trends in other states, they've seen something like this happen and for it to just kind of increase. And what everyone has told me is we kind of got laxed. We thought, you know, we were on a downward cycle. And so we need to keep working this year to support our communities, support our coalitions, and keep advancing our work. And so with that, next steps. What are the next steps that I think we would like to see? We need to transition out of the incident command system, and we'll go more towards the long-term recovery approach. Yep. We need to continue to execute the statewide opioid action plans, build the high-intensity drug trafficking area, and we need to continue to secure more federal funding to build capability and capacity. And with that, I'll move on to the next person.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Jones? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back on the slide, the polysubstance misuse. This is an interesting topic to me. I was work a lot with Partners for Progress in Anchorage, and there was a term that a friend there used, garbage addict, and I hadn't really heard that, and I don't know if that's like perceived in a bad way, but basically the idea of you know, people who are just will use any kind of substance they can get a hold of. And so when you're kind of like looking into that, I don't know beyond other things like in the pharmaceuticals and that kind of thing, if you're looking into that, but just in thinking like that, with when you say people who are addicted to, how are you defining, you know, someone who's addicted to alcohol or addicted, you know, in terms of what that means in that context?
You know, I know, for example, yesterday we were at the Plans of Safe Care, you know, event, and we were talking about, you know, mothers and babies. And so one of the things is if you had, you know, multiple substances, sometimes you get counted double times for it. So I would actually have to talk to our state medical officer, and I can get back to you on that, at least how he actually, you know, picks the substance, defines it. So a lot of times we'll see multiple substances in the body, and, you know, we'll just attribute it to that more, that poly substance. Now, go back to that garbage addict comment. My personal opinion in traveling across the state and the country is definitely would probably put more of a stigma on an individual. It just doesn't sound good, you know. So, you know, I personally don't even like using the word addict, you know, somebody who's struggling with substances, you know, and so trying to be as, you know, as gentle about it to an extent, because there is still so much stigma, and the last thing I want to do is see these individuals go into the shadows again.
Mm-hmm. Good follow.
And what was so interesting about that, I guess, is it also was just the suggestion of that, you know, some individuals in sort of just in this compromised way, right, because of their health conditions, are willing to use things that we wouldn't typically consider recreational drugs, so other kind of medications and things like that. And so I was just thinking about this in that context too. You know, the things that are listed there are things we're more commonly aware of, So just stories I've heard for, you know, things I wouldn't have thought, for example, anti-anxiety medication and things like that. Wouldn't have thought that people use that as a recreational drug. But then, you know, that's, I think, where and I think people who are very empathetic to it, and so that probably isn't the right term, but just the idea that there's, you know, sometimes just a need for whichever kind of mind-altering substance in whatever form somebody can find it, I guess.
So through the chair, Representative Tarr. You're exactly right. You know, I mean, there's multiple substances. One of the things I want to do this year is we're actually seeing a problem with stimulants. And I think people don't understand, one, what a stimulant can do if you misuse it, two, if you misuse it with an opioid. And so those are some of the messaging we want to get out. And we are looking, like, for example, we partner with methadone clinics, some of the drug testing companies, gabapentin, and certain things like that are coming up on the radar. And so that's one of the things in public health and health we're doing, is we're trying to keep a radar on all these different systems, seeing what are some of the different trends. So if we're starting to see an increase, we can start with messaging, education, you know, the whole nine yards before we get into more of the enforcement aspect of things, or they may be doing more looking at the interdiction. So it does worry me that we are seeing an increase in multiple substances being used by the community.
So, Mr. Jones, I think one of the things that Dr. Butler taught me was the value of medication-assisted treatment, and that medication-assisted treatment is really the gold standard for particularly opioid addiction. And I understand that there are some barriers to access to medication-assisted treatment, and I wanted to give you a chance to maybe discuss that a little bit.
To the chair, Representative Sponholz. I think the first thing I want to highlight is there is a definite stigma associated with treatment. So we've moved from use, substance use is a stigma, more to the treatment world. That feels like it's more of our battle in our community. So what I mean by that is Suboxone, you know, versus Vivitrol, abstinence versus MAT, and we got to get past that. If we don't, people are going to, once again, go back to the shadows. So I see that as one of our biggest barriers, other than just building our capacity and capability on services across the state and doing it appropriately where you're getting the medication aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And that's the M, but then also the assisted therapy, you know, side of it. And we want to make sure that these providers who are popping up are providing a complementary service that makes sense and is that gold standard. But that's been one of my biggest works this year, is really working on removing the stigma in relation to treatment. Because if we don't have all three, and when I say three, it's the methadone, it's going to be Vivitrol, and it's going to be that buprenorphine. If we don't have all three of those available, we're going to be talking about this for the next 12, 20, 30 mm-hmm. years. So we got to get past that stigma when it comes to treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think that for a long time, the recovery community, at least people that were public in the recovery community, really, you know, we had the history of the recovery community is really in an abstinence-only model. And what we now know is that that doesn't work for everybody, and particularly for people that have been addicted to opioids, that it's a very difficult physiological process moving away from dependence, and that it takes a lot of time. And so Dr. Butler was very patient with me and took some time to sort of, you know, explain it. You wouldn't tell a diabetic that they didn't need insulin and they should just muscle through it. And it's the same thing is true for people that are experiencing, you know, withdrawal from opioids, that it's actually your body has to change pretty significantly. Access to medication can be access to a normal, productive, healthy life.
Yep.
But that there are still barriers, and you referenced something earlier in your presentation about medication-assisted treatment in prisons, and I'm not familiar with anything beyond Vivitrol.
Vivitrol is the only thing yet. Right. Now, other states have been introducing Suboxone. Now, you'll see the Suboxone, at least what I've noticed, is in the county jails, things like that, where you don't maybe have as much of it. You know, of a large system, but that is one of the systems I would love to see changed in the state of Alaska. We have a captive audience that is behind the walls, and a lot of the times, you know, we could provide them the care. And if we could do it from day one, mm-hmm. and instead of a month before, I think they're going to be a lot better off. I had the opportunity to actually shadow an individual who was released. He has a lot of felonies, and I spent quite a bit of time with him. And would actually call him a friend. He was a good guy. And, you know, it was such a barrier. He was still struggling, mm-hmm. going to treatment, had a job. And I was watching him going, I don't even know how. I couldn't do this. It's almost impossible. So somebody who's being reentered into the community, I just couldn't imagine it. And so I'd like to see something, you know, sooner. Like I said, get that those care, get more MAT, you know, built up, and I think our recidivism rate will drop.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your time today, Mr. Jones. Oh, Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Took me a while, but I figured out that I met you at the state fair last year.
Yes, ma'am.
And I put you down in my contact list as Alaska's drug czar. And I've already got your email. So this is it's just what goes around comes around. The chart following I guess it's the response structure.
Yes,
chart. It's really hard to read. Mm-hmm. And I'm into being able to understand these things, so it'd be good to have. Yeah, it's even harder to read now. That would be good to have a better version of that. And I did collect from you at the state fair the naloxone kit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
And a couple of the disposal bags. I have had numerous contacts from my constituents because drug take back doesn't happen every day. And I was able to distribute those drug disposal bags to these constituents. But how can we get the word out that these are available and where they're available? And if there isn't a drug take-back day every day, in fact, it's very rare to actually have one. How do we get the word out on the availability of these disposal bags? And what do we do with them? Do they go in the trash after they're filled with medicine that you're trying to get rid of?
So through the chair, Representative Drummond. So the ICS chart, the incident command chart, I actually have a one-pager with a nice image. I'll make sure to send to you guys. It actually talks about the whole system and why we did that.
Yeah.
For these products, you guys have my email. Send me an email, and I will make sure we get the bags to you guys. And then and I can set you up with our Project Hope coordinator. We have a website, the www.opioids.alaska.gov, and on there it's got actually the drug disposal bag finder and naloxone. And if we could put your, you know, Anchorage offices, even here when you're, you know, where, however, whatever address you would like, we could actually put them on there. We also have signs. We have all this stuff. So if you shoot me an email, I'll make sure to get you guys all set up.
That'd be great.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it make sense to make those available at all of the pharmacies in the state?
Yeah.
And if they're not already there, is there a reason why not?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, that is a great question. So with this funding, we actually don't have a sustainable long-term funding source for this, and it's not a very expensive product to buy when you think about what we're doing. And so one of the fears I've had, actually, is if I provide it to the pharmacies, I would like them to actually purchase these themselves and see these pharmacies actually provide them for either discount or free, you know, while we're battling this epidemic. I know in a business model that doesn't make a lot of sense sometimes, but community-based models does. And so we would have ran out right away. And so our model we went with is like for Partnerships for Success, Volunteers of America, the different coalitions, we were having them distribute them because we felt like it was a great way for them to connect with the individuals mm-hmm. who were using and having a hard time and the individuals who didn't understand the opioid epidemic or addiction as a whole. And so that's where we've started. If I had an unlimited funding mechanism and supply of these, oh, I'd have them everywhere right now. We'd have them so saturated in the market.
All right, last question goes to Representative Tarr, a quick one.
Yes, thank you. I was just surprised to hear you say that there's now a stigma around going to treatment and just wondered if you could offer a little more on that.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. I think co-chair Sponholz or Representative Sponholz said it pretty well that, you know, it's the recovery community was very abstinence-based, and so all of us have been learning as we've been going along that, you know, you hear from a lot of people like my good friend Karen Nelson, who would say, like, I was in a fog for years, and so they know what it's like to be on Suboxone. And I actually understand what they're saying, and I think what they're trying to say is treatment plans are extremely important in this epidemic, is that somebody may be on Suboxone who's been using for 30 years, forever, but maybe somebody who's using for 20 or 15 years, I don't know what the timeline would be, could have a step down plan eventually. And I think a lot of their recovery community has been asking for that.
Mm-hmm.
I also know that we're really integrating into the criminal justice world. And when you're in the criminal justice world, abstinence-based is a lot more eye-opening and more appropriate probably than a non-abstinence-based. And so I think, you know, when you'd go to different courts across the country, you would hear people's like, well, you're on Suboxone, taper off and get on to Vivitrol. You know, that puts stigma on people. And that's just
doesn't work. work.
It doesn't work. And that's why we see such high failure rates. And so, you know, that conversation, and it's probably some of the new and emerging drugs and stuff that have come out, you know, people are excited about. And don't get me wrong, I'm glad they're there, but I want to just make sure that these other options are available. And just last thing I'll end on, I know a young person who is, and all I'm going to say is this person has been taking methadone for a long time, gets up at 5 in the morning every day, and then goes to work and is such a successful person and is on methadone and has been for a long time, and it works for that individual. Mm-hmm. So one option, we're going to be in a lot of trouble, but having three options is a really good thing. And so, like I said, that's going to be a lot of our work this year is education seems to help a lot, announcements, you know, and just going back to the communities and working with these coalitions. So we worked on use, now we're working on treatment.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much. All right, and next up we have Ms. Jennifer Moreau Johnson, who's going to be presenting over the telephone. Is somebody going to be, who's going to be driving the slides? All right, Mr. Jones is going to stick around to drive the slides. Ms. Moreau Johnson, are you on the line?
Hi, thank you. For the record, my name is Jennifer Moreau Johnson. That's a bit of a mouthful, so you can call me Jennifer Moreau or even just Jen. And here in the office with me, I have the division subject matter expert, Joan Houlihan, available to help answer questions. And if I may check in, Chairperson Sponholz, is the audio okay? Can you hear me well?
The audio is great, thanks.
Okay, great. I thank you very much, Andy, for that wealth of information. What I'm going to present today, and Andy, if you don't mind moving on to the next slide, I'm going to try to describe how the Division of Behavioral Health oversees services, so how we're currently delivering services across the state of Alaska, a little bit of how we got here, what the challenges are, and where we look to go. So just to kind of give context, the programs and services for which the Division of Behavioral Health has oversight includes prevention, early intervention. And I want to call out that for the division, the use of the word prevention is a specific reference to preventing these conditions before the behaviors even start. So this is an early end prevention. This is upstream. We also have the Alcohol Safety Action Program, the Tobacco Compliance Unit, Treatment and Recovery Grant Services, and of course, Behavioral Health Medicaid Services. Today, we're really going to drill down and focus on prevention and early intervention, treatment and recovery services, and then the Medicaid services in the 1115. Andy, if you don't mind turning the slide. So the division engages with communities in order to determine community needs and form coalitions. And these coalitions and grantees use the strategic prevention framework, which is from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. You've heard SAMHSA, the acronym. And through these strategic prevention framework, coalitions assess, plan, strategize, implement, and evaluate community-based services. So an example of coalition work, so every community and every coalition is different, of course. So I'm gonna give you an example. An example is the BU initiative and its positive messaging that's aimed at preventing underage drinking by challenging the misconception that most teens drink. 78% of Alaskan teens do not drink alcohol. People often overestimate the prevalence of risky behaviors among their peers, and research has shown that misconceptions like that can actually increase unhealthy behaviors. These BU campaigns are active in Ukiavik, Nome, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu, Kodiak, Seward, Homer, Sitka, and Ketchikan. And Andy, if you don't mind advancing this slide, we can show you what this initiative looks like. So Andy, if you advance the slide, you can click that arrow and play the video, if you don't mind.
Hurry, animal.
I am one of them. My friends and I don't need alcohol and have a good time to fit in, or even to help get through tough times. We have each other, our families, our community. My health, my future, my goals, they're just too important to me. Most kids in Alaska don't drink. It's true, and I am one of them.
Andy, thank you for running the machine for me. So I want to point out that this initiative is funded by state dollars through the Division of Behavioral Health, but these state dollars actually leverage other funders. So funders for this initiative, for the BU initiative, include the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the MAT-SU Health Foundation, Rasmussen Foundation, the Alaska Wellness Coalition, and the Mental Health Trust Authority, and the Division of Behavioral Health, of course. And with all those funders, of course, there's a keen interest in knowing how well is it working. And so the way in which we assess how well it's working is the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the YRBS. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey asks specific questions about teen drinking. It's an every 2-year assessment. And you can learn more about that if you go to the BUAlaska.com website. So in the future, on the horizon, during FY20, statewide and local community partners will assemble a statewide alcohol prevention alliance to revise and prepare for implementing moving prevention upstream. That's the strategic plan for underage drinking and adult binge and heavy drinking in Alaska. We anticipate the plan will include community-based interventions, statewide interventions, mass reach health communication, surveillance and evaluation, infrastructure administration and management, and will promote brief screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, otherwise known as ESPR. And then Andy, if you wanna move on, thank you. So this slide actually shows the intersection and efforts around substance use disorder treatment. So this is when the problem appears. So we're kind of starting from the early intervention end of the continuum and move from primary prevention, which is the effort to prevent these conditions from ever happening, and now we're in the early intervention end of the continuum on up. And I'm showing this slide to show that there are, you know, intersection and efforts across various components. So this is all part of our system, which is sometimes a blessing and a curse. So there's a lot of intersect, there's a lot of collaboration, there's a lot of there's also a lot of drivers out there. But just in order to kind of understand the graphic, these components are made up of services that an individual may come into contact with that identifies them as someone who needs help, the treatment and recovery providers and services, the agencies that provide the grant funding, agencies that receive the grant funding, and then data sources and data sets. And in this graphic, these are further identified at the community level, the state level, and the federal level. It's important to remember as you look at this that the components will interact with each other within a ring, but also flow both inward and outward within the circle. So for example, data about an individual may end up at the federal level in what's the TEDS, the treatment episode data set, while funding from the federal level gets funneled through the state down to the individual. So we move back and forth about, throughout this this continuum. And I wanted you to have this image as we look at the distribution of substance use disorder funding across the state by service area and program type. So this slide, you know, illustrates, you know, a lot of effort and great achievement on part of the state, the federal government, and certainly our provider agencies in piecing together a system. But it also represents a system that is pieced together. So using state general funds, a myriad of federal grants, and Medicaid, and each, again, with its own reporting and management requirements, and each with its own set of unique regulations, the result is that we have these services, which is great. But service providers are struggling to keep on top of the administration and yet still provide the service. And we also end up with an uneven distribution based on a variety of influences for how these services are available across the state. So again, what we do have 26 outpatient programs specifically funded by the Division of Behavioral Health for substance use disorder treatment, including youth. What we do have is we have 4 methadone clinics, 1 in Wasilla, 2 in Anchorage, 1 in Fairmix. We have 366 medical professionals certified to treat addiction using buprenorphine. I can't start. You know what I'm talking about. Buprenorphine. Andy, you can probably
buprenorphine.
Thank you.
Buprenorphine.
And we have 22 residential treatment programs, which is 300 beds. 4 women and children's programs, and 3 youth programs. So we have a lot. This graphic shows how much we have. But again, it also represents the fragmentation. And so as we look forward, I'll talk a little bit about some of our solutions. But briefly, I'll touch on reducing the administrative burden to providers, which we are anticipating being able to do through onboarding the administrative services organization. And when I talk more about the 1115 waiver, I'll talk about that some more. But one effort, one initiative we have in play is bringing on the administrative services organization with a performance measure of reducing the administrative burden of providers providing these services.
Ms. Murrow?
Yes.
This is Representative Sponholz, and I just want to jump in here for a second. I think there's a really important data point that is not in this chart that's very important. In this this chart shows for 2019 that we're going to spend $26.7 or $8 million in addiction treatment, but that's just in the grants. What's not reflected in this is also the Medicaid payments for substance abuse treatment that is being spent. And you know, the Department of Health and Social Services sent a chart to me that I was sort of expecting was going to be in this presentation, so I didn't bring it up earlier. But in 2015, we spent about $38.5 million on addiction treatment through Medicaid billing, but by 2018, that number was up to almost $151 million. And we went from about 13,000 people who were getting addiction treatment through Medicaid billing in 2015 to about 30,734 last year. So there's a big piece of our addiction treatment system that is not reflected in this chart that everybody is looking at, and I just wanted to get that out there now, and I'll make sure that I share that chart that the department was so generous in providing to me with everybody on the committee as well, because I think that's a very important data point. The grants are not the only addiction treatment in the state of Alaska. In fact, most addiction treatment in the state of Alaska is being paid for by Medicaid. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Sponholz. We would be very happy to help facilitate the distribution of those charts to everyone on the committee, so let us know if you'd like us to do that. So we can go to the next slide, and Chair Sponholz, as you mentioned, the Medicaid coverage for substance use disorder treatment is an essential funding source for treatment. It is also how we look forward to developing a more robust continuum of care. And again, I'll talk about the 1115 waiver. We are anticipating that with the implementation of the 1115 waiver, we will be expanding our funding to include federal match, and that would be a more sustainable source, and that the continuum would be equally distributed regionally across the state. So to that end, the Mental Health Trust Authority has funded a study. We are nearing completion of our infrastructure analysis study. So with these new federal funding opportunities through the 1115 and the new federal funding opportunity through the Family First Prevention and Services Act, this gap analysis was aimed at exploring the capacity of existing service providers to leverage these new funding sources, including Medicaid, in order to expand existing services or onboard new services. So you can see that we visited these 14 communities. At this point, we have met face-to-face in their community with 68 agencies across the state. We have about a half dozen to go. These visits, I really want to thank our partners at the Mental Health Trust Authority for funding this. These visits were incredibly informative. We had candid and deep conversations with our providers about what it means to them to bring on the 1115. We are collecting specific data related to the volume of screened in and out child protective service reports, the number of children in custody. So, and OCS was present with us in these at these site visits across the state. We will have the report complete towards the end of summer. We're still collecting surveys. We're still doing some follow-up, and we're putting together the data, and we will have a report available to the public with recommended action. And then my last slide, and I know I've presented to this committee before about the Section 115 waiver demonstration project, but just for context, that was required of the department in 2016 through Senate Bill 74, and in 2018, the state submitted its application. In November of 2018, we received approval from Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So the, we received our first approval. It was unexpected, but we were given a fast track. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services created an opportunity for states to fast track the substance use disorder components of the Section 1115 waiver, and that's what we received approval for. After the approval, it took several months to negotiate with CMS and an implementation plan. We have approval for our implementation plan. This is all publicly available and available on our website, or I can distribute these documents directly to you, committee members, if they like. And we are now in the phase of hurriedly getting regulations in place, and we are targeting July 1st implementation of the substance use disorder services through the Section 1115 waiver. I believe I've distributed the list of services that are approved. I'm happy to go over those if you want. It is the full continuum from community-based services, from peer and recovery services, to residential treatment, all the way up to the IMD exemption from the IMD exclusion. That is an exemption from the CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, exclusion for what they call institutions of mental diseases. That means facilities of 16 beds or more. So this approval for substance use disorder treatment goes all the way from community-based all the way up to that IMD exclusion for facilities of 16 beds or more.
I'm thrilled that the 1115 waiver includes, allowing for larger facilities, because 16 beds is a real financial strain. It's hard to operate a facility that way. But if you could also describe a little bit more of the community-based services, I'm not sure that everybody on the committee knows what that means.
So there's a new, thank you very much, and Chair Klonholz, I am pulling out my my documents to describe the services. So I'm referencing our approval documents, and these again are all available publicly online. We are offering a bucket of services through community recovery and support services. These community recovery and support services, I call it a bucket, because it includes component services. These component services include peer supports. It includes assistance navigating social services, including housing assistance, transportation. It includes support and employment, which is essential for the recovery model of care. It includes case management. So there's multiple component services that are delivered to the individual in the community setting to help people recover fully and become contributing members of their community.
Can you remind the committee how it is that people will be identified as being eligible for the services you're describing?
So any substance use disorder diagnosis would make someone eligible for this full array of services. And the way that people will be identified is the Section 1115 waiver demonstration project promotes universal screening. So we're implementing ESPRT, which is screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment in every setting, from hospitals to primary doctor offices. So we are, we actually have provider roundtables going, identifying the best screening tools and practices and assessments, but we are going to stand up screening universally.
Thank you. Does anybody have any other questions for Ms. Moreau-Johnson on this topic? All right, no other questions there.
Well, thank you. That was my last slide. I understand is focused on substance use disorder and treatment, but I really just want to add that we are continuing to negotiate for the services and the remaining sections of the waiver. And one which is, I believe, relevant and meaningful to the efforts that you guys are looking at is the target population of at-risk family and youth. Because, we talk about bending the curve, and the way to bend the curve is to address adverse childhood experiences. And that is how the at-risk family and youth population will be identified, is through screening for indicators of adverse childhood experiences, one of which is substance use in the home. So if a family is identified at a well child check, again, going to our universal screening model as living in, there's a list of social determinants, one of which is substance use in the home, they would be eligible to receive in-home support to help a family remain whole and healthy. And that is the end of my presentation, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions? All right, there are no questions for you, Ms. Moreau-Johnson. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, next we're going to go up to Bradley Grigg, who's the chief of behavioral health at Bartlett Regional Hospital, who is in the room, who's going to be presenting with Sherry Hinshaw, CEO of Volunteers of America, and Lance Johnson, the administrative director of behavioral health services for Norton Sound Health Corporation. All right. Mr. Grigg.
Thank you, Representative Spunholtz. For the record, my name is Bradley Grigg. I am the Chief Behavioral Health Officer of Bartlett Regional Hospital here in Juneau. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak about what is going on at our hospital and what we're seeing from the patients that are coming through our doors that we serve statewide. Bartlett Regional Hospital has a broad addictions program on our campus that includes a residential treatment facility. As Director Moreau-Johnson was talking about, we have historically had a 16-bed facility, mainly because of the IMD exclusion. It's been kind of that set business model that we've had to attend to in order to bill Medicaid for our services, which is about 95% of our population historically, pre-expansion and post-Medicaid expansion. So we are really excited about the possibility of the 1115 waiver helping us to expand that, which is part of the reason I'm here today. Historically, we have served co-ed adults in residential treatment for 16 beds, and we are currently in the process of expansion with that program to not only expand our residential treatment beds, but also our withdrawal management, also known as detox beds. We are in the process of adding four specific detox beds to Rainforest Recovery Center's facility that will provide detox for alcohol and for opioid withdrawal. This is a combination of City and Borough Juneau funds and Bartlett Regional General funds that are funding this project, and our construction is set to begin in about 2 months. So we are shovel ready and ready to go. The bid has already been awarded. So what we are finding is we haven't been waiting on our referrals and numbers to increase in order to expand. We've been waiting on an opportunity for the IMD waiver to assist us in doing that so that we could bill Medicaid. Obviously, if we had more than 16 beds, we couldn't bill for any of those patients who were Medicaid. Now we will be able to. So we are also, in addition to the detox beds, we are looking at, within our current facility as well, adding additional residential treatment beds to our existing 16. So we are looking at a minimum of 20 beds total that will help us serve these patients, but also we are looking at as many as 24 total, and that would include the detox patients. We have, given the fact that we're a hospital, we have been able to provide detox services for years. We do it on our medical floor as a medical service. The challenge has been with the opiate piece because it is a very different level of withdrawal. It's the medical concerns, the risk associated with opiate withdrawal as opposed to alcohol withdrawal is very different. So we're grateful for the opportunity that we've got to build these beds that will not only address our ongoing needs for alcohol detox, but also opioid detox. One of the Bartlett-specific data reports that we've seen over the last 3 years, and I did not bring it today, but I'm happy to show it, is historically alcohol has been the number one drug of choice of our patients who come in through their self-report, to the point that in FY18, four out of five of our patients, 80%, reported that alcohol was either their number one drug of choice or their only drug of use. Obviously, over the last 3 years, what we have learned is that drug abuse is not a monogamous relationship when it comes to individuals struggling. So we are taking a polysubstance approach in what we do. Ironically, compared to 3 years ago, we have seen a distinct shift in the patient populations we're serving. Instead of it being 80% self-reported drug of choice being alcohol, we now see that number down below 55% for alcohol, with the other 45% splitting evenly between methamphetamines and opiates. It doesn't mean those individuals aren't using alcohol, but it means that their self-reported drug of choice is now, we are now serving individuals who are preferring to use opiates and methamphetamines over alcohol. I don't think it means that the, I'm not sure it means that the these folks are not using alcohol, but what it does show is the folks that are coming through our door and coming into treatment, which I think is a positive sign in some ways, is that we are hitting those individuals who are now more than just alcohol. They're reporting that it is opiates and methamphetamines. In addition to our residential treatment and detox, we also provide outpatient substance use services to kids and adults. And with the assistance of the Division of Behavioral Health, we were recently awarded a combination capital and operational grant to build a crisis stabilization program for adults and kids ages 10 and up. It's two separate programs that will be housed in the same facility that will not only serve behavioral health needs as it comes to mental health crisis stabilization, but also substance use stabilization that could be in the form of 23 and a half hour observation for a person who is intoxicated and possibly suicidal at the same time, but does not have the room. Does not have the capacity for us to be able to put them on our inpatient mental health unit. I think what we are seeing from Rainforest is that the reality in which our system as a statewide system has, as you saw from the graph from Director Moreau Johnson, Rainforest Recovery Center, as are a lot of our 3.5 residential programs, we serve individuals statewide. As of today, I have a 16-bed facility on any given day. We have 16 patients in those beds. The only way at this point over the last 6 months that we have not had a patient in a bed is because we've had a discharge and we've obligated it to a patient and we're waiting on them to arrive. As of today, our 16 patients, 12 of them are from not even from Juneau, they're not even from Southeast. So we are serving folks from Northern Region to Southwest to the Kenai Peninsula and of course Southeast as well. So I think one of the challenges that we are seeing from access to treatment as quickly as we are able to get individuals in and to say we are full, which is a good thing, we're treating as many as possible. Also today I have 13 people on my wait list to get into treatment from all over the state. I can't speak to how, if they are on the same wait list as our partners in the other communities, but I can say that from our standpoint we're having daily contact with them and their referral sources, whether it be a primary care physician or a case manager from a community behavioral health center, letting them know basically we can tell you based on our anticipated length of stay in our program is about 24 days. So we're able to really look at over a 3-week period how quickly we can get someone in. That doesn't mean that everyone stays 24 days, but that's really been our average over the last couple of years. So we have a bottleneck effect at Rainforest that's kind of a statewide impact, because when we're taking individuals from all over the state, while we do treat Juneau and Southeast individuals, at the same time we prioritize our wait list based off of who has come to the table for acceptance first, and possibly who has the most complex needs. I think the challenge that we see every day with our patients is it's not just addictions that they're struggling with. There's comorbidities around medical conditions, there's diabetes, there's hypertension, there's high blood pressure that's associated with everything else that they have experienced in life in addition to their experience with addictions. And so when we look at trying to meet the need, do we feel that 20 beds are going to meet that need? No. But we have the opportunity, and with our staffing balances, we believe that we can add these additional beds without putting extra pressure on our staffing outside of adding additional psychiatric and medical coverage, which is critical to the service we deliver. We're opportunistic and we're optimistic that adding these beds is going to help be a part of the solution, though we're only one agency of many doing that.
All right.
I would also add, because I know it was a priority that was discussed by Andy, is that we do also provide medication-assisted treatment, both in our residential and our outpatient programs, in the form of Suboxone and Vivitrol. As was noted by Director Moreau Johnson, there is no methadone services per se in Juneau or Southeast, but we do have Suboxone and Vivitrol access that we use in our outpatient and residential programs.
How many people are you able to serve in your outpatient program?
Specifically to MAT?
No, for addiction treatment overall.
For addiction treatment, to the chair, we currently have just under 100 individuals who are in outpatient treatment for addictions. Our outpatient program serves both mental health and substance abuse and co-occurring disorders. And so the caveat there is I say 100, but that 100 is where it's primary. Substance abuse is primary over mental health. What we do know is of those other, we have 200 active patients in our outpatient program. Of those other 100, a vast majority of them also have addiction history or maybe current experiences with addictions, but mental health seems to be their driver at that point in time when, as to why we're serving them. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Griggs? Representative Drummond?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm new in this committee, and I'm starting to understand what the 1115 waiver means and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Are those limitations what kept you from growing beyond 16 beds?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, that was a major driver. It, mm-hmm. it definitely wasn't meeting the need, but being able to have a business model that would sustain itself and provide treatment at the same time, 16 was the max we've done for over two decades now, mainly because of the IMD exclusion.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm mm-hmm. looking at your list that you provided a link to us the other day, uh-huh. and most of those facilities are 16 or under.
That's right, and that's also because of the Institutes for Mental Disease limitation on billing. At wow. the federal level, it was a federal regulation that was passed a long time ago.
Starting to come on here.
Yeah, it was that rule was put into place because in the lower 48, there was a problem where people who experienced mental illness were often housed in large institutions, and people were sort of put in these large institutions that operated more like prisons really than they operated like healthcare facilities. And so there was a rule that was put in place at the federal level that said you're no longer going to be able to do that. It had good intentions, and it resulted in the deinstitutionalization of people that had primarily really been warehoused for mental health issues or developmental disabilities of various kinds. But there was an unintended consequence that allowed us to not be able to have mental health care facilities and substance abuse treatment facilities that were economic to operate. Mm-hmm. And so now, many states across the country are applying for waivers that would allow them to have larger facilities now that we have a more patient-centered model for how we do things, and we know that we won't be warehousing people, or we believe we won't be warehousing people, but there was a good reason for it. It had some negative consequences.
Right. To the chair, if I could just add one more thing to my report, and I can be done unless there's questions. Mm-hmm. Since SB 91, Criminal Justice Reform Bill, two fiscal years ago went into effect, one of the growing pieces that we've also seen as far as our referral sources are from DOC, individuals reentering the community. So one of the dynamics that we did not used to see that we are seeing now is the challenge of a bed-to-bed transfer is what we call it. Mm-hmm. The key to having an available bed when an individual is discharged from corrections and to get them from bed to bed is critical because the time from discharge to the time to the hospital, a lot can happen. And so one of the things that we're trying to do with these additional beds is that we increase that access for bed-to-bed transfers because we know that if we can get them into a bed as soon as they are discharged and continue the treatment, if they've had any in corrections, mm-hmm. but if they haven't had any, initiate that treatment, we have a better chance of helping them to be successful as they exit.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. Did that complete? Oh, Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize if you had already provided this information, but is there a prioritization process as you consider with the wait list that you have? I know that, for example, there's a medication-assisted therapy program in my home community, and there are priorities for individuals, say, expectant mothers, people who've had close encounters with overdoses. I'm just curious to know if the program down here also has a similar prioritization process, and if so, what that is.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Zolowski. We have federal regulations that guide part of our practice around priority populations. That does include pregnant women. IV drug users are also a priority. So when we look at wait lists, obviously those rise to the top, no matter where they're coming from in the state. So whether they're from northern region or southeast, those two are our priorities, populations, which we do actively serve in our program. So
thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I think next up we have Sherry Hinshaw.
Hi, testing the line. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Great. Hi, my name is Sherry Henshaw. I am the president and CEO of VOA Alaska. We're an Alaskan-based company providing behavioral health services to youth since 1981. We have a residential substance abuse treatment program, a 24-bed facility located in Eagle River, Alaska. We have outpatient and intensive outpatient programs in Anchorage, and then some prevention and early intervention services that are in Anchorage and then other areas as well. We do serve youth all over the state. The primary ages we serve is 13 to 24. With that, we also have affordable housing as a family and senior housing, a youth supportive housing program for homeless youth, and a kinship care program for families who are the primary caregiver of related children due to parental substance abuse in the house. And I have a number of things to cover with you today and really tell you a little bit more about what we do in VOA, but then also how that relates to the system, the substance abuse system we operate in. But just to kind of ground us in why we're here, the youth we see at VOA are trying to fill a void. They feel lonely, scared, pushed aside, and they are often self-medicating. I've been thinking about just the development of life and where they are. There's impulsive behaviors, they don't have a fully developed prefrontal cortex, and then when you add in chaotic home life and trauma, there's a number of barriers that they're facing, and our goal in working with them is to help them grow, change, overcome the obstacles. The journey of recovery looks different for different people, and it's really helping them find meaning and purpose in their life beyond just what their substance use profile says. So we see on a daily basis the impact of trauma and addiction in our communities, and we see this partner, the state, as a partner in this work. And with that said, we, with VOA's decades of serving families here in Alaska, we've obviously been through times of instability and fiscal challenges, but really these last few years have been unusually difficult for us and for many others, and I talked to a number of other providers just in preparing for this conversation. To make sure that I'm representing more points of view as well. But just to start with some data, the Anchorage Health Department recently presented a few weeks ago to an assembly committee about a very comprehensive community assessment around substance misuse that they had carried out. What that showed, and it really echoes what we see in our work too on a daily basis, is that alcohol remains the most misused substance. That stigma around behavioral health treatment remains a barrier, even if we have made gains. That a lack of diverse treatment options and modalities prevent access to care. Use of meth is increasing. We also see, especially in youth, increases in vaping and the effect of adverse childhood experiences and intergenerational trauma as all factors that we need to focus on. Substance use disorder rates of Anchorage youth are among the highest in the nation, at 6.54% compared to the U.S. rate of 4.13. So with the teens, the high school students we're seeing, and as it represents in the data, it's around the misuse of alcohol, vaping, marijuana, tobacco, and prescription medications. So in my time today, what I wanted to focus on with you is three major areas, sort of the reality of life as a provider and trying to deliver these services and that mission. I wanted to start off about our mission and why we're doing this work to kind of ground us in that. The second thing being gaps in the system, and the third thing being sort of stability in the system. So the first thing being the realities of being a treatment provider is operating in a business environment. We have to run a business that is consistent and available for those who are seeking care, and how funding and system decisions that are made affect our ability to consistently deliver those services and grow to meet the needs of the community. There's a high level of uncertainty with funding, and it's hard to imagine another system where the expectation is to grow to meet demand and live in that uncertain funding system when lives are really on the line. And what does that actually mean? That means that for the family seeking services, they don't know where to go, they can't get the care that they need at the right level, or they can't get the full continuum of services that they need. Funding availability directly ties into my ability as a provider to hire clinical staff to deliver those services, which ties directly into our ability to serve the number of individuals that need our services. The gaps in the system that we see are around work with parents, working with the whole family. Currently, that's not a reimbursable service. There are a number of things that I'm going to address as gaps in the system that the 1115 does address. But with that said, there's a number of concerns I want to follow up with as well. Partial hospitalization is a gap in the system, especially for youth, where they can access the same level of clinical intensity of services that they would in residential, except go home at night. And there's been examples of states using this model to do recovery high schools, where it's really centered around recovery and trauma-informed care while they're addressing deficits in education and continuing on their high school. There's gaps in the systems around peer mentoring and support, which is also included in the 1115, and we're very happy to see that. Prevention is a gap in the system, and I really want to spend a minute on this, is even looking at that chart about SED treatments, SED investments that the state makes. There was about $2 million there in prevention, and then if you take the other 24 plus Medicaid, it's clear that we are not investing in prevention in the way that we need to in going upstream. And there are some amazing professionals across the state who are taking that investment in prevention and turning it into really meaningful things. Andy talked a lot about the community coalitions. VOA is a part of those coalitions, a part of distributing those naloxone kits. And really, we have to do more in prevention so that we shift away from being a crisis response system. The last thing I wanted to talk about then is sort of this level of uncertainty. If you think about a well-functioning system, a system in itself is an interconnected set of elements that are organized in a way that achieves something. And if you step back and think about the Alaska Behavioral Health System, it's often focused on crisis management versus prevention or being a responsive system that changes as the environment changes and as community needs change, both on this continuum of health promotion, prevention, early intervention, treatment, and recovery. The state, we have to look at how do we adequately address all of those areas. We teach our clients at VOA to not be reactive, to respond in the moment, and to regulate emotion so that they can make the best possible choice. And that parallels what comes to mind when I think about the 1115. There are so many wonderful things about it, and it addresses so many gaps in the system. And my caution is that the devil's in the details, because the reality of what we live in as a provider right now is that rates do not cover the cost of care. They have not covered the cost of care, and it's been at great expense to our agency to continue to provide services that we know are needed and to meet our mission. And with the recent Medicaid rate increases in January, which we're incredibly thankful for, even the new rates do not cover the cost of care. That really is a limiting factor in organizations' ability to grow to meet the need of the community. There, with the 1115 and the timeline of implementing that, there are a high number of unknowns with what that will actually look like and how that will change services on the street for those who are seeking them and those families in care. And so what I would like to ask is just as much as possible to think about rolling out change in a way that can be a manageable steps so that we don't destabilize the system that we do have by trying to change too much too quickly. And if I'm thinking about the things that I'm hoping you'll get from this conversation and from my presentation is to understand the reality of trying to offer these services, and that if we don't have stable and consistent funding and that level of certainty, it's difficult for providers to confidently deliver and grow those services that we know are needed. We have to shift away from being a reactive system and and being crisis-driven, which means we have to look at the whole consistent, the continuum of care, and then rolling out changes in manageable steps that don't destabilize what we do have. And I'm thankful to each of you for everything you do to address community needs and make the communities a better place. I have two little ones. I was born in this state. I plan on living in this state until I die. And I want it to be a beautiful place for our families and the generations that follow us, and thank all of you and our partners at the state who are working to help design systems to address substance misuse.
Thank you, Ms. Hinshaw, for your insightful comments. Co-Chair Zelkowski has a question.
Ms. Hinshaw, your comments about not destabilizing the system and the need for stable resources to provide reliable treatment support for individuals who need it and providing opportunities for providers to grow their programs really resonates, especially with the backdrop of all of the financial decisions and challenges that the legislature is grappling with. Are there particular areas of revenue or support that come into programs that you've identified as being stable and being able to, I guess just being stable lines of resources that are coming into various programs? Can you articulate what those are for the committee?
The comprehensive behavioral health treatment and recovery grants that are the $26 million slide that Director Moreau showed, that is really the gap filler that funds everything that Medicaid won't. And so any cuts to that, which I believe there's proposed cuts right now, and some of the what's been, and I can pivot this question back to Director Moreau if it's more appropriate, but the purpose for bringing the 1115 online on 7-1 would correspond with grant cuts. And so having grant cuts at the same time as adapting to a brand new system that has many things as yet to be defined is very concerning for providers. So it's those cuts in particular that I'm referring to.
Follow up?
Yeah.
And I anticipate you were on the line when Co-Chair Sponholz was talking about the significant amount of investment that Medicaid has made in treatment services. I also anticipate that the Medicaid treatment funds are also critical in maintaining moving forward. In your perspective, that I don't want to put words in your mouth, so if you could just clarify for me, that would be great.
Absolutely, and I apologize for not focusing on that. Medicaid cuts, considering that in behavioral health, Medicaid rates were not adjusted for over 10 years, and they, even with the increases, they do not cover the cost of care. Any cuts to those to Medicaid directly impacts our ability to deliver services.
Final follow-up?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this perspective. If there were to be cuts made either in Medicaid funding or in those grants that we were describing, what would the impacts be at the community level that you would anticipate seeing?
The impact would be that what availability the system does have right now would obviously lessen. And so even for us, for VOA, for example, we would have to lower staffing and not, we would have to lower staffing in our outpatient, intensive outpatient residential treatment programs to a level that we could sustain. And that would mean that we would serve less youth who were coming in for services.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Hinshaw. And I just want to take note of the time. It's 4:35. We have three people left still to testify. We have Lance Johnson with Norton Sound Health Corporation. We have Doug Woolliver with the Alaska Court System, and we have Adele Landrock as well. And I want to make sure we get to everybody, so we're going to need to just be very judicious with our time in the last few minutes here. And I want to next move to Lance Johnson with Norton Sound Health Corporation Behavioral Health Services.
Thank you to the chair and the members of the committee. Testing the line.
Perfect.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lance Johnson, the Director of Behavioral Health Services at Norton Sound Health Corporation in Nome, Alaska. And I appreciate all the comments that my colleagues had, and and all the comments before that really highlight the issue that we are here to address and look at is the rampant substance misuse concerns that we have throughout the state. So I can draw back in the interest of time on some of the statistics, but I'm pleased for the invitation to speak to give a rural perspective and to highlight a couple of positive developments here in Nome that can benefit the state as well, namely our wellness center that we are in the process of building and also our day shelter that we open. As a bit of background for those who aren't familiar, Norton Sound Health Corporation serves the entire Bering Strait region. It's 15 remote villages. The hub community is Nome. And the tribal corporation operates the only hospital and behavioral health services in the region. Just for scope of size, the region is 24,000 square miles with 9,869 people, and we're only accessible by airplane. I've been in my position as director for behavioral health since 2012, and like many places in the state and what we've heard, our needs are high and our needs are visible. We're very fortunate to have committed partners in the region who collaborate around common concerns that impact the well-being of its members. As a point of example, in the last month, in recognition of the very public concern around substance misuse in our area, a public safety coalition, which is one of many homegrown grassroots organizations and coalitions that have gotten together to address basic needs and wellness, this public safety coalition came together to examine the substance misuse issue and develop strategies working outside of our silos with the goal of achieving measurable and sustainable change. These partnerships are wholly important to a region where localized care and treatment can have most effective change. And the state of Alaska, I don't want to neglect to say, has been a committed partner in many of these efforts through grants and collaboration with tribes and tribal entities and through expansion efforts. And to be able to speak today to possibly further that collaboration is impressive to me. Again, I will pull back on the statistics. Again, we all have glaring needs and we recognize the issue throughout the state. But that's a negative. The positive is this. Norton Sound Health Corporation has devoted staff and resources to projects needed to help with that substance misuse. And I want to highlight co-occurring concerns. We can't overlook the significant contribution of historical, intergenerational, and other traumas often masked through substance misuse on the wellness of the people of the region. On December 29th in 2018, the corporation opened a day shelter in an old BIA building to offer a warm weather and safe place for the several people that we would see on the streets who were chronically homeless and at varying levels of intoxication. The idea was not only to keep them safe, but to meet them where they are. It's foolish to think that everyone who has a need is going to walk through the doors of behavioral health ready for treatment. Change and recovery will not always occur within the four walls of a clinic. So we need to meet people where they are. We need to build trust and rapport, which is something I'll highlight in just a minute. The day shelter operates 7 days a week, 8:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. And since opening, we've served 122 unique individuals. Nearly 100% of the individuals have claimed homelessness and are misusing substances. All of them on triage forms are saying their top priorities are housing, employment, and treatment. The day shelter is very grassroots. It's small. It's not the greatest setup physically in comparison to more established shelters throughout the state, but it's a need and it's an important one in the continuum of care in this region. Currently, BHS, Behavioral Health Services, that I oversee, offers outpatient mental health and substance misuse services. And these are, of course, wholly important treatment options for many people, but they're not enough. A full continuum of care is necessary anywhere to address the multitude of needs any one group of people may have. Because of this, the corporation has worked on the development of the aforementioned wellness center that I highlighted, and that would offer this full continuum. The center will have outpatient, it will have intensive outpatient, day treatment, and a sober housing that will replicate residential treatment. This means that people can come in from the villages in our region and have a place to stay while they're getting their treatment for however long that may take. It's been a 9-year project. Oh, I should also mention, too, that we also will have a sobering center within that complex as well, which will serve as an entry point for many people into the their services. But it's been a 9-year project. We've had planning support from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and so far the corporation has secured $7.1 million towards the project, with much of it invested by the corporation, leaving $8.3 million to investor raise, and pilings were put in the ground this past year, so it's ready to go. these are important efforts here in this region because we know that localized care is the most effective care, and right now we are grossly limited. The construction and operation of the Wellness Center will allow people to stay in the region surrounded by their familial and social supports, which is imperative to successful recovery. And as importantly, treatment will be culturally reflective and familiar to people because it's in their own region. Every time we send a person outside for substance misuse treatment, they're most often isolated from their supports and their culture. And the family component to treatment, where people learn and recover together, is often lost. I'm grateful for these services that are out there, but because recovery can have many hills and many valleys and is a lifelong journey, staying home wrapped in supports and resources offers the better and more sustainable outcomes. I want to give a really quick example of someone that I'll refer to as Kenny that we've been working with for the last 2 years. Over the years, Kenny's had more days of intoxication than sobriety, unfortunately. In the last 2 months, he's been to our emergency room over 30 times, admitted to the inpatient unit 3 times, and arrested 3 times. Kenny's needs will only be met through higher levels of care that we don't have here, and we've coordinated that twice for him in the last year and are currently attempting to do it right now. What's really important to note, through this first 7 months of our relationship, Kenny would rather curse us than engage in services. We were the scourge of the earth for him. But through our commitment to work with Kenny where he was at in his life and to offer support, we built a working relationship, a trusting one, a revealing one, and one where we are able to scrape beneath the masking substances and address those underlying co-occurring issues. The point is, this doesn't happen in a day with someone in the throes of addiction. You have to build that trust to get to the core of the problem. Right now, Kenny can go to a 35-day program, or he can wait for 5 or 6 months for a bed in one of the state's longer-term residential facilities. And the 35-day program has its place, and I'm thankful for the resource again. But it took us 7 months to build trust with Kenny and to gain daylight into his severe trauma history, the catalyst for that addiction that he has. So if we could keep him home, and this is also the place where he said he would feel the safest, his word, safest, getting treatment. If we could do that surrounded by his supports and his culture in a care environment he trusts and opens up to, Kenny's going to spend a lot more time on the hills than he is down in the valleys, which is all that we want. So I'm happy and thankful that the interest in this committee is in possibly looking at ways that we can partner with agencies that might have these capabilities. And while, of course, I'd love to say, yes, here you go, Norton Sound Health Corporation, we want to partner with you, and here's that missing $8.3 million. I'm more interested, actually, in having the opportunity to partner. And I want to give an example, because I think we build a lot of infrastructure in the urban areas, and I think there needs to be a renewed energy in building infrastructure in rural Alaska. We know that the more we can provide locally, the less strain it's going to put on an already overburdened and under-resourced system. The less I have to send people out of region for services and tie up those beds that Bradley has, the less it overwhelms the system, the less it costs in emergency room care, incarceration, and police resources. Because, again, people are getting the right care in the right place, leading to recovery. But this happens best when rural communities have the same or similar opportunities as non-rural communities. By example, there was a request for proposals released by the state of Alaska for state opioid response peer support services on November 21st. And, of course, I was excited about this. When I read the goals and requirements, it perfectly aligned with our day shelter and the recovery coaches we had hired to work with the target audience and the RFP. But, unfortunately, the opportunity was restricted to communities and urban areas. And further disheartening, this was only a month after there was another opportunity that would have worked perfectly for us that was only available in urban areas. So don't hear me wrong, I don't begrudge those areas because their needs are just as real as ours. But the danger is if we continue to invest only in the infrastructure of urban communities or mostly in the infrastructure there, then rural communities will continue to depend on those out-of-region services, leading to more cost, more strain, and more people struggling to achieve recovery sooner in the continuum. I appreciate your time today and the consideration that you've given for this.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Johnson. Are there any questions for Mr. Johnson? All right, seeing none, we're going to take a quick at ease. For everybody's indulgence, we're going to flip the order a little bit. I want to make sure that we have the opportunity for Adele Landrock to testify. She's been on the line for a very long time, and I think her testimony is very important. Ms. Landrock?
Yes.
All right. Could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Sure. My name is Adele Landrock, and I am a member of the Anchorage community. I'm a mother, a grandmother, and a retired teacher. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak to this committee today.
All right, you want to proceed with your testimony?
Sure. I have something prepared and I'm going to read it because I'm a lot more efficient that way. It's my hope that by coming before you, I will leave you with some additional knowledge and insight into the world of addiction. As I'm sure many of you have already heard, addiction is not just the disease of an individual, it affects family and friends of the addict as well. I am living proof of that. While my experiences have been difficult and sometimes tragic, I'm not all that different from any other parent of an addict. My three adult children have all struggled with substance abuse. My oldest son died of an overdose administered by his girlfriend who left him to die alone. My daughter struggled through two pregnancies, fighting her heroin addiction, and has emerged on the other side as a happy, successful adult. My other son abused drugs as a teenager, went to treatment twice, and was clean for 7 years until his brother died. He struggled with this and has been actively using for several years. He's been in and out of jail and was recently remanded in January. He wants to be clean, he wants to be happy and successful, he wants to be a good dad, son, and brother. However, he can't do it alone. It's not enough that his friends and family are there for him and that we support his sobriety. What matters is the resources that are available to him when he feels weak and lost. And when you have to navigate the system of assessments and admission paperwork and filling out forms, etc., doing it on your own as an addict must seem an insurmountable task. I'm hoping that by sharing my story with you and making the world of addiction a little more personal, it will help you to understand and to have some insight into the challenges that the addict and his or her family faces. My son was remanded to jail in January and immediately started the process for admission into a residential treatment facility. His requests went unanswered or were rejected by corrections staff. In an attempt to facilitate his admission to treatment, I sent dozens of emails and made multiple phone calls with little success. Over the next couple of months, he was sent back and forth between Anchorage Jail, Cook Inlet, and Goose Creek. It seemed like every time he started to make some headway, they would transfer him. He continued his efforts to get on the list for an assessment, and I continued sending emails and making phone calls. Most of them went unanswered. One CO at Goose Creek, Kyle Thompson, took an interest in actually helping my son and facilitating this process, and he finally got on the list for an assessment. That's how his paperwork didn't get to the treatment facility's intake, and so it was another series of emails and phone calls and help from the same CO at Goose Creek until the necessary documents were received by the facility. Then it was a waiting game until the bed was open for him. I'm happy to say that he's finally in treatment and is doing well. Sadly, though, my son's story is typical of what happens within DOC. Lots of waiting, unanswered requests, and resistance. My son had the benefit of having me outside the system, and fortunately for him, I am someone who persevered until his assessment and admission were completed. Many inmates don't have this support. I have also seen the same kind of process that other addicts have tried to work through outside of DOC to get into some treatment program. There are very few detox beds in Anchorage and in the state of Alaska, and if any of you know anything about addicts, if they're asking for help right now, it needs to happen right now. Addicts are known for their lack of persistence and follow-through, expecting someone who is actively using to make a phone call every morning to see if a bed is open and available is not realistic. The process of being admitted into a treatment facility is so cumbersome that many addicts either never begin the process or give up. Once a person is fortunate enough to go through detox, then it's a waiting game to get into treatment. I spent some time looking at the real-time chart of beds available and open beds in the state, and much of it doesn't make sense to me. There are facilities that listed a number of open beds that had a waiting list, which went from a few days to more than a month. For instance, on May 3rd, the men's treatment program at Clitheroe has a total of 42 beds, 37 of them occupied, with 5 open beds. There are 24 people on the wait list, and the estimated day's wait time for the next available bed is 45. If you were the addict waiting for your chance for an open bed, would that sound promising to you? I have seen all kinds of wonderful plans in writing from different task forces and committees within the state, as well as the mission statement that DOC has published. This all sounds really good on paper. However, I see very little evidence of any of these great ideas being put into practice. We talk about crime in our state, and I'm not an expert. However, I have done my fair share of research, and a common theme that runs through many of the people who are committing crimes and are incarcerated is substance abuse. We seem to be attacking this problem from many angles that don't seem to have a direct effect on reducing crime in our community. I have listened to debate after debate and complaints from many people in the state talking about SB 91 and the problems that are inherent in it. I have heard very little focus on the causative issues such as substance abuse and support for people following incarceration. Again, I'm not an expert, but I know how it goes. A person is released from jail, has no money, no job, no place to live, and very little support in the community, and they're back on the streets. They seek out the people that they previously have associated with in the community and return to the lifestyle that they were living prior to being in jail. This is a catch-22 for most of them. And even for those recovering addicts who truly want a better life and are making the effort to be a positive, contributing, productive member of society, it is truly an uphill battle. I don't wonder why most of these people don't succeed at staying clean and sober and being gainfully employed. I am amazed that some of them actually make it. It's imperative that after identifying the underlying causative factors for addiction and crime in our state, we actually develop a plan to address these issues that is reasonable, practical, and doable. We can't keep talking about it and doing nothing and expect things to get better.
Ms. Landrock, thank you very much for your comments and your testimony. And with regard to your statement that you're not an expert, I would actually respectfully disagree. I think that you are an expert, and I appreciate your testifying. Yeah. Coach Rizalkowski has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but Ms. Landrock, for somebody who has endured such heartache, you provide a very concise, clear description of the need for treatment in our state, and I just want to thank you for courageously sharing what I'm sure is a very difficult story to share, so thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
You've given us something to think about, and I thank you for your courage and your vulnerability in sharing your family story with us today. I think this is a good segue over to inviting Doug Wolliver with the court system up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doug Wolliver, Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. And I think I'm going to change what I was going to say, but one of the things that particularly Ms. Landrock's testimony highlights is one of the great benefits of therapeutic courts is it takes out all of that confusion and delay associated with trying to find a way into treatment. I mean, the story she just told, and I think one of the other testifiers mentioned also, it seems almost impossible to deal with all the things you have to deal with and to get into treatment and to find the treatment and to keep up calling every day to see if there's a spot available. One of the great things about our therapeutic courts is we have contracts with treatment providers in our locations around the state so that, and then part of that contract is once the person has shown an interest and looks like they might be a good candidate, they're assessed within 5 days for their needs. Then there's a little bit of a delay while the attorneys work out a plea agreement and they make sure the assessment is appropriate and that they're a good candidate for the court. And once they're accepted, then the contract is they're in treatment within 5 days. And we have help. We have, you know, the therapeutic courts provide help. They can provide help with housing, both finding it and through grants, particularly through Partners for Progress, who have always been tremendous champions for the therapeutic courts and just terrific participants. They provide, it's from a grant, it's a state-funded grant, they provide emergent funds for people to help maybe cover the first and last month's rent, you know, bus passes, those types of things that could otherwise make trying to get into a treatment program or be successful in treatment just all but impossible. So those types of programs are really, really helpful. We have, at any given time in our therapeutic courts, we have about 280 people. I think last month in March, or at least, we had, 283 people. Over 1,300 people have graduated over the years from therapeutic courts. You know, like corrections, the court system is a direct bridge between treatment and the criminal justice system. Of course, corrections has treatment programs within their facilities, and we have the therapeutic courts to provide a treatment as a way to keep people out of those facilities. And we talk a lot about recidivism rates and how you measure recidivism and recidivism under SB 91, and recidivism is incredibly important, but there are other benefits to getting clean and sober. And one of the other benefits that we don't talk a lot about is things like how many healthy babies are born to someone who went through or is in the therapeutic court program. Over the years, we don't keep data on this, although I wish we did, and I think we're going to start doing this. Between 15 and 20 women going through our programs became pregnant and gave birth to healthy babies in a therapeutic court program. And when you think about, we've all heard for years how much, say, for example, a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder child ends up costing the state in the long run. That doesn't count, of course, for the human tragedy of the syndrome itself. And it's also a crime reduction tool. We were talking about, one of the other speakers was talking about the need for prevention and not just back-end work. Well, therapeutic courts are back-end work. We're handling people who already have a problem and who are already in the criminal justice system. But when you have a healthy baby born, that's prevention. That's keeping an FASD baby from coming down the pipeline, more likely to be in the Division of Juvenile Justice, more likely to be in the adult correctional facilities as well. So that's at least a piece of the prevention angle that comes out of the therapeutic courts.
Mr. Oliver?
Yes.
What percentage of people who work their way through the court system every year participate in therapeutic courts?
A very small percentage. Mm-hmm. We have, like you say, 280 people at any given time. I think we have about 400 people over the course of a year. And of course, we have thousands and thousands of people mm-hmm. in the criminal justice system. It's a challenge getting people into therapeutic courts.
How do people get identified to participate in therapeutic courts?
Frequently, their attorney will tell them about therapeutic courts. Mm-hmm. Other people in jail tell them about, in fact, we heard a story in one of the committees the other day of a person who learned about therapeutic court from his cellmate. Mm-hmm. And he'd just been kicked out, but he was going to try to get back in because he liked it so much. And that's how that he came in. But usually it's through the attorneys who get in. But it's hard. The substance abuse courts are about 18 months long. Mm-hmm. And as you know, a lot of the people who are going into therapeutic courts have been to jail many, many times already in their life. And going to jail for 90 days isn't that big of a deal. 18 months of intensive outpatient treatment is a big deal, and a lot of people, well, they have to be ready to do it before they'll start down that path. And that's one reason too. A lot of our defendants are felons. There's more time hanging over their head, more to avoid. I know we're short on time. I could go on and on about therapeutic courts. They're good programs. We'd like to have more. Mm-hmm. We have as many as we can right now.
All right. Well, I think that you've given us something to be a little hopeful about, although I hesitate to get hopeful about something that serves such a small number of people in our state. I wish that we could do a lot more therapeutic courts because I think they are so great. It's 5 p.m., and we have a hard stop at 5 p.m. tonight because there's another meeting that we need to get to. Thank you to everybody who testified today, both in person and on the phone. I think this is an important thing for us to be discussing at this point in time. The time is 5 p.m., and the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.